So I think it's important to start way, 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 way back. You know, Jewish community was still very, very small. In 1654, you had 23 Jewish refugees from Brazil who came to New Amsterdam, what later would be New York City. And the Dutch director general of the colony at that time was Peter Stuyvesant. And Peter Stuyvesant was not enthusiastic about welcoming these 23 Jewish refugees. In fact, he basically said, you know, they're basically not welcome. And after some, you know, back and forth, he relented only on the condition that they would take responsibility to care for their own poor and not be a burden. And so this became known as the Stuyvesant Pledge. The Stuyvesant Pledge, which was basically, you know, you can come here, but only if you take care of yourselves. And that was when you first had, and it was a very small community at that time, but you began the concept of Jewish voluntary social support, education, health networks, welfare systems, trying not to be a burden. And this is what had been done in countries where Jews had found themselves previously. I'm still not able to share the screen, but I'll just keep going. But so there's a great picture of Stuyvesant. You can Google him as well. That's all you missed in the first slide. So that obviously at that time, oh, here we go. So here's my PowerPoint, and there's Stuyvesant, if you're curious, in case you're curious what he looks like. So then we come to really the first wave, because there wasn't really major hospitals or Jewish institutions yet, obviously in 1654, and slowly the Jewish community gradually and slowly increased in America. But your first major wave of Jewish hospitals begins around 1850. In fact, when you start looking at which was the first, they all claimed to have opened up right around 1850, 1852 in Cincinnati, in New York. And this really happened primarily because there was a shortage of United States hospital beds. At that time, there were a number of urban epidemics, such as the cholera and yellow fever outbreaks. And the founders of these hospitals expressed feeling shame that they couldn't care for their own. There were many Jewish sick, and you know, there was this pledge, there was this responsibility to care for your sick, not to be a burden. And they framed it in a very positive way at that time. You know, we don't want to be a burden. We have a responsibility. There's Jewish values of tzedakah and of bikur cholim, which means, you know, giving to the poor and of and visiting the sick. But when you start looking into the historical documents of what was motivating people, at Jews at that time, it was more than just that positive impetus of trying to help. There was widespread missionizing of sick Jews in American hospitals. There were many reports of Jews, when they would be laying in their beds in hospitals, being forced to listen to scriptures being read to them against their will. There were deathbed baptisms and conversions happening. And obviously the sickest and poorest were the most vulnerable. And it was a big challenge being Jewish in American hospitals because of being exposed to this type of anti-Semitism and difficult treatment. And also many Jews wanted access to kosher food and religious services. There was a request for cultural sensitivity, for a rabbi, for holiday observances, for avoidance of autopsies, which we'll talk about again in a minute, symbols like mezuzahs, space in the hospital for Brit Milah, for circumcision. Interestingly, actually Mount Sinai, which opened in 1852, one of the very first, some say the first, but one of the very first Jewish hospitals in America, when their first facility had a synagogue in it and no operating room. And actually, one of the minutes from one of their first board meetings, one of the board members pointed out that that was an expression of their values. Yeah, we don't have an operating room yet, but we have a synagogue. That's what it means to be a Jewish hospital. And that shows something about their priorities, which is fascinating. So there was this a desire to have a place where you could observe your cultural and religious traditions while you're in the hospital, and obviously not to be exposed to persecution, to anti-Semitism, to real anti-Semitism of, you know, being, you know, going through these forced experiences. And one of the first major decisions that you found at all of these hospitals when they first started opening up in the 1850s and 60s was this decision, okay, we are opening these hospitals to protect our co-religionists and to enable them to observe their religion, but should it be open to all people? Should they be open to non-Jews as well? Is this a place for everyone? In the discussion, there was, well, you know, Jewish values express care for all humans equally. Obviously, there's a value of caring for all people. And maybe even it will reduce anti-Semitism, right? We can pacify. by them. If we're nice to them, maybe they won't hate us anymore. And so it became unanimous, really unanimous, at all of these Jewish hospitals that they should welcome everyone. They were never meant to be exclusively for Jews. In fact, many of them boasted that they had equal numbers of Jews and non-Jews. So, for example, here you have a picture of the Jewish hospital in Denver, 1889. At their opening ceremony, they said the following: "Our goal is to rear a temple unbounded by any creed. As pain knows no creed, so this building, the prototype of the grand idea of Judaism, which casts aside no stranger, no matter of what race or blood." Similarly, on the entrance, literally posted on the entrance of Jewish Hospital in Philadelphia, 1886, there was a plaque. And that plaque read, "The hospital was created by the voluntary contributions of the Israelites of Philadelphia and is dedicated to the relief of the sick and wounded without regard to creed, color, or nationality." That was very important to the founders. At Beth Israel, in New York City, Beth Israel Hospital, 1890, they said, I think this is beautiful, "Beth Israel, like Abraham's tent," which was known for being open on all sides, "like Abraham's tent, will be open to sufferers without distinction as to race or creed." And at Beth Israel, which is that's what's pictured there in the picture, in 1908, their rabbi, at the dedication ceremony, said, "While this hospital shall be mainly supported by Jews, it will open its doors just as wide as they can swing to receive the non-Jew who may desire to enter, and his religious sentiments shall be carefully safeguarded." In fact, actually, in 1902, Cedars, Casper Cohn was founded, our hospital. In the 1920s, when Cedars of Lebanon moved into its site at Sunset in Vermont, right, which is today the Scientology building. But when they first built that building and named it Cedars of Lebanon, it was momentarily called Southern California Jewish Hospital. And then they concluded on calling it Cedars of Lebanon. And also, the rabbi at that opening ceremony said, why Cedars Sinai? Why Cedars of Lebanon? Well, the temple in Jerusalem, the ancient temple, was built out of cedar wood. And they were known for being very grand, huge trees. And they were also referred to in the Torah as having medicinal properties. But anyways, the rabbi at the opening ceremony said, "It's Cedars of Lebanon, and just like the temple in Jerusalem was the house of prayer for all peoples, as it says in the Bible, so too will this be a temple of health for all." So it was very clear from the very beginning that the Jewish hospitals were meant to be a place of healing for everyone. This is meant to be for everyone to be welcome. So that's really the first wave and the first major issue. But what we have today in terms of Jewish hospitals really, really begins to become prominent with the second wave. And that's what I want to focus on now for a minute. The second wave really begins in the 1890s, late 1880s, 1924. And that is coinciding with the time period in which over 2 million Eastern European Jews immigrated to the United States. That was a massive influx of Jews in America. In fact, all four of my grandparents came to the United States in that time period. And with that massive immigration, and many of these Jews who immigrated at that time were largely very poor, more observant than Jews who had been in general and Jews in America at that time. And there was a very high burden of tuberculosis, disproportionately higher volume of tuberculosis patients amongst these immigrant Jews, and therefore they were frequently resented by Americans. And so in this time period, until you had the Immigration Act in 1924 preventing more Jews from coming, there was an increase in American Jewish hospitals by five times the amount of American Jewish hospitals. And we begin hearing reports and seeing them published of severe mistreatment of Jews in American hospitals at this time. You see writings about Jews being referred to by their doctors as being dirty Jews, subhuman, being very difficult, being very nervous. In fact, in medical textbooks, literally in textbooks that were approved and used by medical schools in America, and this Kraut showed us this when he came to speak here 10 years ago or so, that in the textbooks where American medical students were studying, there was an illness called Hebraic debility. Hebraic debility was the condition of basically being Jewish. And they were afraid, the Jews were so nervous and dirty and difficult that they had this Hebraic debility, or what they would also call Jew neurasthenia. And they were concerned that it might even be contagious. So they said, watch out for the Jews. They're dirty and contagious. And, you know, obviously the doctors couldn't speak the language and they didn't have cultural sensitivities. And in fact, we have writings of many Jews who were afraid to enter American hospitals and preferred worse care at some of the startup Jewish hospitals than higher quality care in the mainstream American hospitals. Now, that was one issue that was happening. So increase in anti-Semitism. But then there was another impetus, and this is a very famous, which was that at this time, physician apprenticeship was transitioning from homes, from kind of private apprenticeship with an individual doctor, to the modern medical school, to hospitals, right? Hospitals are becoming much more sophisticated. Medical schools are now attached to hospitals, and they will not welcome Jews, right? Jewish medical students were being harassed. They were not being given jobs or privileges. There were even, now this is going a little later, in 1934 in Montreal, the staff went on a strike to protest because they hired a Jewish doctor. Because they hired a Jewish doctor, the staff went on strike and protested. You know, even when Jewish doctors could, you know, could get privileges, they would have to wait weeks longer to get their patients admitted. In 1927, for example, we know that there were thousands of Jewish physicians in New York City. There were zero at any university medical school. Zero. They had severe quotas. So at one time in the 19 teens, Columbia College of Physicians had 47% Jewish students. By 1920, it was only 6%. So the Jews were really being kept out of medical schools, of hospitals, and the Jewish community at this time rallies to the cause. And in fact, so much so that 25% of Federation grants were going to building Jewish hospitals. And also, just by the way, Jews couldn't donate elsewhere. Jews who wanted to be philanthropists could not, people would not accept Jewish money. So they were giving it to these hospitals. It became the major cause. And it was still a challenge. There were many Jewish hospitals that reported that when they tried to buy land to build their hospitals, no one would sell them land if they knew that it was to a Jew or to build a Jewish facility. So it was very complicated. Even when these Jewish hospitals were built and Jewish medical schools were happening and Jewish doctors were getting trained there, then when they tried to get residencies at American hospitals, they wouldn't be given residencies. And when the Jewish hospitals said, okay, we'll start a residency program, the accrediting boards would not accredit these hospitals. So it was a major challenge, and it caused a huge increase in Jewish hospitals where they were saying, you know, we're going to have to build our own hospitals. So that really leads us into the, you know, 1930s, 1940s, and you have this, you know, at this point you have 113 Jewish hospitals in America. Then things start to change. There is a third wave. The third wave. You can see this there, right? You're now in the third patriot, right? It says third wave and decline. So the third wave, there was a third wave, meaning it didn't just decline. What happened was Jewish communities often moved to different neighborhoods. That was significantly the situation in Beth Israel in New Jersey, for example, and many other places, Chicago, for example. But there was the Hospital Survey and Construction Act of 1946, also known as the Hill-Burton Act. And this act created thousands of new hospital beds, rebuilding hospitals, relocating hospitals, oftentimes in suburban areas. This enabled many older Jewish hospitals to relocate. Also, many of the quotas limiting Jews, you know, cultural shifts happened in the 1960s, civil rights, and it was obviously no longer accepted to discriminate. And anti-Semitism, at least in a very public and official way, was not being enforced by these hospitals. And also, by the way, as a side point, the focus of anti-Semitism, fighting it, shifted from what was combating it through philanthropy, trying to appease non-Jews and say, look, we're really nice, we're not so bad, and we share, to in the 1960s, to fighting it head-on through organizations like the ADL, things like that. So anyways, Jewish patients also were now receiving better treatment at non-Jewish hospitals, and many of them opened kosher kitchens and hired a rabbi or had access to ritual needs, religious needs. So you didn't see as strong of a need for the Jewish hospitals. And also in the 1960s, you have Medicare and Medicaid. So this decreased the reliance on philanthropy, right? And the competition between hospitals increased, and this caused many smaller hospitals to suffer and oftentimes then close. So by 1981, Jewish federations only allocated 2.3% of their budget to Jewish hospitals, right? So it had gone from 25% to 2.3%, and today it's almost 0%. So you had, at one time, and I'm going to share my screen in a minute, but just to now talk about this for a second. So as I mentioned, you had at one time 113 Jewish hospitals in 24 different cities, right? And these are created as a response to significant anti-Semitism, which had institutionalized itself within the medical system, whereby Jewish doctors couldn't get training, they couldn't get jobs, they weren't welcome. Jewish patients were receiving suboptimal care. The Jewish community felt a sense of responsibility to not be a burden, but also to care for everyone. And so they built these hospitals. But now you're having a situation where, you know, these hospitals are struggling, and the impetus, the need for them is being challenged. Is it so essential anymore? So we go from 113 Jewish hospitals in 2012, 24 of those hospitals had either merged with other Jewish hospitals. So that's an example of us, Cedars of Lebanon and Mount Sinai. They either merged with each other, 35 closed, and 24 had been purchased by larger health systems, by non-Jewish health systems or hospitals. And so by 2012, just 22 Jewish hospitals remained in America. Today, there's different ways of defining what it means. We're going to talk about this now. What does it still mean to be a Jewish hospital? But depending on your definition, there's between 5 and 10 left. So that's significant. We went from 113 to as low as 5 today. And you can see, so these reasons have changed, the needs have changed. So is there still really such a need? And by the way, the last year that I have data on this, I'm looking for more updated, but in 2016, when we talk about religious hospitals in America. In 2016, 19% of hospitals in the United States were religiously affiliated. Now, since at this time, nonprofits in the United States, nonprofit hospitals, as you know, are declining. However, at the same time, Catholic healthcare, that is increasing. So the majority of those religious hospitals are Catholic healthcare. So that is kind of a summary of what it's meant. But what I want to talk about now is, so what has it meant to these people who founded the Jewish hospitals? When you ask them, okay, I gave you the historical impetus, right? Specifically related to avoiding anti-Semitism, responding to anti-Semitism, desire to care for all, right? Avoiding being a burden, and desire to have places where Jewish doctors could receive training and practice, right? And then having culturally sensitive care. But, you know, what has it meant to the people throughout, since the 1850s, when you ask them and you find in historical documents, what did they say it meant to be a Jewish hospital? That's what I want to share now, and then I'll transition to kind of what could it mean in 2022. And remember, when it comes to Jewish hospitals, and I just mentioned Catholic hospitals as an example, Jewish hospitals never had the same kind of central authority. There was never like the same way that a Catholic hospital ultimately reports up to the Archbishop and the Pope. I mean, there's a centralized kind of authority and structure and guidance for Catholic healthcare. There was never the same kind of centralized church base when it comes to Jewish hospitals, and we don't have the same kind of articles of incorporation that kind of enforce fulfilling these principles. But in terms of what it has meant, to be a Jewish hospital, I mentioned to you before the rabbinical thesis. So this D.E. Bridge, I don't know much about this person, but they were a rabbinical student at Hebrew Union College, and they did also a doctorate there. And they wrote their doctorate on the rise and development of the Jewish hospital in America. In 1985, they wrote this. It's not available publicly, but the library will share it upon request, and I requested it and got it and read it. And it was fascinating. And they share in there, and you can see my screen now, right? Just, you can nod your, yes, okay, good. So they argued it's basically a book, it's over 100 pages, that it meant 9 different things throughout history. Number one, to be a Jewish hospital, they argued, meant to be founded primarily by members of the Jewish community. So who founded it was important. Number two, built primarily for members of the Jewish community. So never exclusively, and never even, you know, close to 100%, but that the impetus was that there was these needs in the Jewish community, and that was why it was built. Number three, that it was funded primarily by members of the Jewish community. And as we saw, for partially historical reasons, as you saw from some of those quotes, you know, I think it was most clear, especially in the Jewish Hospital of Philadelphia. Remember when I read that, like, they literally put it on the entrance, on a plaque, where it said the hospital was erected by the voluntary contributions of the Israelites of Philadelphia and is dedicated to the relief of the sick and wounded without regard to creed, color, or nationality. They were trying to mitigate anti-Semitism, right? They were trying to say, we're making these donations to show that we want to help the world, and no one else will take our money. We want to do something good. Number four, a Jewish name. Interesting that they found this to be crucial to what it means to be Jewish hospital. As a side point, by the way, I read Yitzhak Rabin's history of Yitzhak Rabin. Yitzhak Rabin was, of blessed memory, was the prime minister of the state of Israel until he was assassinated. Before being prime minister of the state of Israel from, I think, like 1968 to 1973, in that ballpark, he was the Israeli ambassador to the United States. So he lived in America. And I read in his biography that when he would go around the country speaking, he was someone who was not Jewishly observant at all. Actually, they write about him that when he came to America, he became more observant for those few years because just being Israeli wasn't enough. You had to kind of find an identity. When he went back to Israel, he then felt like he didn't need to have a religious identity, but just an Israeli national identity. While he was here speaking at Jewish communities, it says in there, it doesn't say which one, I have no idea, maybe someone could shed light because I have suspicions, but he was speaking at some Jewish hospital in America, and he rebuked them, and he said, you are a very proudly Jewish hospital. Why is your name hiddenly Jewish? If you think about it, you can understand why it's Jewish. But why didn't you have a more obvious Jewish name? Like so many hospitals were called the Jewish Hospital or, you know, the Jews Hospital, like so many in America. But why have a hidden name that only implies that you're Jewish? You know, be proud of it. Anyways, that's what he said. And you could argue that's true of, let's say, Mount Sinai's Cedars of Lebanon, right? Mount Sinai was, by tradition, a moment when everyone who was sick healed. So that's the reason for the name. And Cedars of Lebanon, as I mentioned, was a temple of healing. So it has biblical reference, but they argued that, you know, a Jewish name is part of what it means to be a Jewish hospital. Number five, governed primarily by members of the Jewish community. They felt that's important, the governorship, the leadership. Number six, staffed by an especially high percentage of Jews. And actually, I want to dwell on this just for a second as well. When we say it's staffed by an especially high percentage, what does that mean? 95%, 80%, 5%? You know, what does it mean? So it's interesting. I always point this out because many times people come to Cedar Sinai, just as an example, and they say to me, oh, I'm surprised. There's so many people who are not Jewish here. And I say, what do you mean? What do you expect? This isn't a modern American hospital. Everyone is welcome. Everyone's treated equally here. There's never any precedent or any kind of, you know, differentiation between Jew and non-Jew here, and there never has been, even since it was called, and this is true, the Hebrew Home for the Hopeless and Incurables, which was really not a name that they ran by marketing before they chose. But, you know, even when it had, you know, and it was called Bikur Cholim Hospital after that, you know, very Jewish names, it was never Jewish only. And what I often point out is, you know, our patient population here at Cedar Sinai is 22% Jewish. Now, on the one hand, I always point out, that's very low Jewish, and if you think about it, it's, you know, it's majority, you know, 78% are not Jewish. The vast majority of patients are not Jewish. It's not like it's a mostly Jewish organization or institution. On the other hand, if you consider the fact that Jews make up only 2% of the whole country, so 22% is very high. So you can have a situation whereby it's like, oh, having 22%, we have a lot of Jews. That makes it a place where Jews feel very comfortable and welcome at the same time where it's by no means majority. So everyone should feel comfortable and welcome. So that's part of the point I make out. It's kind of like this dichotomy of being both very Jewish, but also not overwhelmingly Jewish. It's not like it's mostly Jewish. Number seven, they argued, it's viewed as Jewish by the Jewish community, which is kind of like, I don't know. I mean, we're reading this definition. The definition is, what does it mean to be a Jewish hospital? If you see it as being a Jewish hospital, I mean, but that means the Jewish community. And by the way, just as a side point, and I'm not meaning to compare and contrast institutions, but just because it helps in terms of making having these conversations. You know, the rabbi at UCLA shared with me, and I just point this out because it's so close, it's 4 miles away, and it's a great hospital as well. But they have less than 10% of their patients are Jewish. So it's interesting. Why would we have such a high percentage of Jews at Cedar Sinai when we're in the same neighborhood, basically? And I think it's clear that there is something about feeling comfortable and welcome at a Jewish hospital that, that many Jews are attracted to, even though, once again, it's by no means primarily for or by Jews only. Number eight, they argued, a Jewish hospital adheres to Jewish religious or ritual practice to a greater degree than other religions or ritual practices, which is a fascinating one. In other words, they're admitting that Jewish hospitals throughout history have allowed and encouraged and welcomed all sorts of religious practices from all sorts of religions. But that sort of like the public face, the publicly observed religious practices might be slightly more Jewish than the non-Jewish religions. You know, maybe on Christmas time, instead of having a Christmas tree in the lobby of a Jewish hospital, you might have a menorah. Even though, of course, people who want to celebrate Christmas are celebrating Christmas in a Jewish hospital. It's just like kind of what are the most public or the majority of the public displays. It's an interesting one. And number nine, finally, they argued that a Jewish hospital is a place in which Jewish patients feel comfortable. That, in other words, that there's cultural sensitivity, not displaying symbols from other faith traditions, especially in the rooms, which is what some of you find in many hospitals, like a symbol in the room that could be off-putting, and in language care, which often meant, Yiddish, obviously, today in Los Angeles often probably means also Farsi, Russian, and obviously, if we're talking about the Jewish community, but then of course, Spanish and other languages as well. So that is the argument that they make in terms of what has it meant to be a Jewish hospital in all these cases. What I want to conclude with, and make sure that we have time, you know, for a conversation. So what I want to conclude with is, you know, how do we take, and this is my challenge, right? How do we take that history and then apply it to the modern day and make a case for what it should mean today? On the one hand, you know, you could just make the argument, well, look, there's a certain integrity, right? There's a sacred trust. There were people that donated money, right? You know that Cedars Sinai in 1976 or whatever the year exactly it opened, I think 76, you know that they were very proud of the fact that it opened without any government funding. This building that I'm sitting in right now was built by community donations, by community philanthropy. They were very proud of that fact, that the Jewish community, non-Jews as well, but primarily the Jewish community, rallied around the cause to build these hospitals. In 1929, that Cedars of Lebanon, when I mentioned that rabbi that spoke, one thing I didn't mention, the rabbi spoke and he said this is a temple of healing. In that speech, he mentions that he helped to fundraise the $1 million. So this is an unheard of amount of money that we raised to build this building. They raised $1 million. You think about the numbers today that we talk about, but that was a big deal at that time. And so you could simply argue there's a sacred trust. There is just people gave of their resources to build these institutions. And here we are today, the beneficiaries of that innovation, that giving that they did. And so there is this sacred trust to kind of keep alive their, at least their memory, their values, their purpose of why they built it, right? We remember that. I remember, and I see some people on this call I know as well as me. I mean, I remember many of these people who built this hospital, and we want to do right by their memory. Also, I mean, anti-Semitism, it's not the same as it was in the ways that I mentioned. I mean, we don't have it happening in an institutional, formalized, official manner, but anti-Semitism exists still today. I mean, it is real. It is a real concern still. And there is a need for the Jewish community to be concerned about that and have institutions whereby we can ensure that people are protected and safe from any kind of discrimination that might exist. There people talk about a sense of community and there's important communal values, but I want to go a step deeper now. And I want to make basically three arguments in terms of how do we use this history of what initiated the Jewish hospital in America to make the claim that it is still important today. I'll give away my cards from the beginning. I believe that it's still important. I'm not going to say, you know what? I see we don't need it anymore. We're done. No, I do believe it's very important and it's a source of significant pride and meaning and values. And so I want to make three arguments for that. And I'll share my screen to make these three arguments. Argument number one, do you see there now what it means to be a Jewish hospital in America today? Good. Okay. Number one, inclusivity. And I mean this in a very deep way. And by the way, we talk about, inclusivity today. I don't want people, inclusivity is important. I don't want to start making it sound like, oh, he's just saying what's, popular to say in our culture today, of course you say you're inclusive. Of course you have to be inclusive. But what I want to argue is that the history of the Jewish hospital gives us not just that we have this value, but it gives us a solidarity. And not just a solidarity, but a sense of obligation, an obligation to embrace marginalized populations. Because we remember this hospital exists because of horrible things that happened to people who were marginalized in the past. That's why we're here. That's why this building is here. That's why this institution exists. So if we're here because people were mistreated in the past, it's not just like, oh, I have a sense of, you know, human rights, which is good. I'm not saying, I'm not trying to belittle, but it's like, it's not just a sense of rights. It's like, it's even deeper. It has to be even stronger. Like, we have to be on the forefront of fighting for human rights and dignity. Just like the Torah says, the Bible says over and over again, the most repeated commandment in the Bible says, do not oppress the stranger, for you know what it feels like to be a stranger, for you yourselves were once strangers in the land of Egypt. And if we take this in the modern context, we ourselves built this hospital. I'm not saying we, I'm not trying to be exclusive. I'm saying the hospital was built because people were excluded. So this very institution, when I talk about Jewish hospitals, exists to prevent, to fight, to protect from anti-Semitism, from people who were not given jobs or opportunities to practice medicine. And that's why, so we have to be extra dedicated, not just that we care about diversity, inclusion, equity, but that we have to be extra, you know what I mean? Extra dedicated. And by the way, it's been our history the whole time. It's not just a history that we were excluded. It's our history that we have been inclusive. I have a picture there of Dr. Sarah Vassen. Now, my computer skills are not good enough. I admit I'm not good with PowerPoint. I got this picture of her on the web. I wanted a picture of just her. The only way I could find was her with someone else. But the point of this picture is her. Is Sarah Vassen. Sarah Vassen was the first woman to hold a supervising position and a position as a physician in Southern California. And that was here. That was at Casper Cohn at the time, at Cedars of Lebanon. And, you know, to me, it's very significant, you know, that that institution that was being told, you know, we won't take your graduates, we won't take your residents, we won't give you accreditation. And they said, okay, you know what? Then we're going to hire the people that we want to hire. We're going to hire the people that are needed, and we're going to hire men and women. We want to welcome everyone. And especially when we talk about cultural care, she was an obstetrician, and there are many women who are saying, we want our babies delivered by women. But why aren't you training women to be doctors? And Casper Cohen said, yes, we will train them, we will hire them, and we'll put them in positions of leadership, in fact. And by the way, speaking of Cedars of Lebanon, not only that did they hire Sarah Vassen in 1906, but during the Holocaust, I mean, we're experiencing this in the world today. You know, when you have a refugee crisis, many German doctors during the Holocaust, and even before the Holocaust, in the 1930s, were being fired left and right. The Nazis did not want Jews working in their hospitals, and they were firing these researchers. And Cedars of Lebanon reached out and welcomed them and helped to bring them to America, to Los Angeles, and gave them jobs. So it became also a safe haven. So that's our history. By the way, it's not just within the Jewish community. So 1947, the Jewish Hospital of Cincinnati, that was the name of the hospital, Jewish Hospital of Cincinnati, which was, by the way, many argue, actually the first Jewish hospital in America in 1850, they hired two African-American physicians in opposition of Jim Crow laws. And I can share with you if anyone wants to see, the minutes from their meetings where they made these decisions, and they had something like 50 applicants for two positions, 48 of whom were white and two were African-American, and they only hired African-Americans. They hired both of the positions they hired were for African-Americans. They wanted to have diversity on their staff. And there were Jim Crow laws. I mean, this is before the Civil Rights Movement. I think this is an important point about the history of Jewish hospitals. 1951, Louisville Jewish Hospital. That was also its name, Louisville Jewish Hospital. They hired Dr. Jesse Bell. That was the first African-American physician to be hired in that region. 1951. So this was an important part of the history, going all the way back to the founding of Jewish hospitals. So that's number one, inclusivity, but radical inclusivity. Number two, also very profound and meaningful and relevant today. I argue that a Jewish hospital is unique because it's a hospital that has religious foundation, religious base, but it's not faith enforced. Religion is not forced on anyone. It's faith-friendly, not faith-enforced. Religious coercion, that phrase itself, by the way, is really an oxymoron. That's what I wrote here, that religious coercion, the concept of religious coercion is an oxymoron in that you know, religious coercion, first of all, it's ineffective. People don't want to do things when they're forced to do it. If you, you know, if religion means it's something that, you know, has a person has a personal sense of desire, of spirituality, they want to engage in something, but if they're forced, they don't believe in it. Also, not only does it not promote religion, it causes backlash. People don't become, not only don't they become religious when they're forced to, but they become anti-religious. They hate it. Like, no one wants to be forced to do something or believe something. And also, it's bad for religion for those reasons. I think it gives religion a bad name, and it undermines religion. It undermines, you know, we should be able to teach by the strength of example, you know, to influence, not to force people. And so the Jewish hospital is unique that sort of in the tapestry of hospitals in America, that there could be places where all procedures could be carried out, right? There's nothing that's forbidden in Jewish hospitals. You know, some religious hospitals, and I'm not saying this to critique them, you know, some religious hospitals do not allow certain procedures. Jewish hospitals, all procedures are allowed. But there is, you know, so for example, autopsies is a classic one that was debated. But they are facilitated. People's religious beliefs are facilitated. So, for example, we have very aggressive religious accommodation, not only policies, but we are very aggressive in terms of enforcing that religious accommodation is respected. So, for example, many Orthodox Jews don't accept brain death, you know, determining death by neurological criteria. They think that a person has only died once their heart has stopped. But by California law, by American law, a person is dead either when their heart stops or when their brain function is no longer active. And so what do we say? Oh, you come to Cedar Sinai, it's a Jewish hospital. Therefore, we only determine death by cardiopulmonary criteria, not neurological. We wouldn't enforce those beliefs on any patient. However, we would say if there's a patient for whom their, you know, strongly held beliefs are that death is only determined by cardiopulmonary criteria, then we will do our best to accommodate them as much as possible, right? We try to accommodate religion. We don't force it on people, but we enable it. We allow it. You know, I'll give you an example as I begin to conclude that I think is profound. And I just think it summarizes the idea. We once had, some of you might remember this case, we once had a Muslim patient from the Gulf states who, their imam, their sheikh, told them that they had been possessed by a demon. That was why they were sick. And the only way to get it out was to have an approved imam read verses of the Quran while they would also draw blood, the imam, draw blood from their big toe. So when this idea was presented to the nursing staff and the medical leadership in the ICU, they said, well, you know, okay, we're going to have to come up with something else because obviously we can't have non-clinicians coming to the hospital drawing blood. And so the answer was no. But us as a, you know, when we heard about this, we thought, you know what, this is a Jewish hospital. We need to put our values into practice. If we believe that a Jewish hospital is a place that is faith friendly, we would never enforce it, but we would enable it. We should fight for this. Let's fight for that. And let's see if it can be done. So we reconvened, we met again, and we tried to figure out, is there a way to do this safely? And we discussed, and we found a way, you know what, we could. There could be a way that the imam could come in, guided by the nurses, all cleanly, very carefully, and they could draw blood, recite the verses, and we could let it happen. And it did happen. And actually, that patient recovered afterwards, which is why we now draw blood with an imam from the big toe of every single patient that I see. No, I'm joking. We don't do that. But it was incredible. And afterwards, I remember that imam said to me, like, wow, you know, even at a Jewish hospital, you enabled this. And I said to him, no, it's not even though it's a Jewish hospital, it's because it's a Jewish hospital. That's part of who we are. That's what it means to be a Jewish hospital. It's that it's faith friendly. We want people to be able to observe their religious traditions here, and we want to enable it. We would never enforce it, but we enable it. It's faith friendly, not faith enforced. And that's a unique perspective. You know, I would not want to send a patient, let's say, you know, autopsies. I gave that example before because that has been very contentious in Jewish history. Autopsies are traditionally frowned upon by Jewish law, right? We try to avoid them. However, there are some times when they are allowed. So there were some people that said, oh, to be a Jewish hospital, you should forbid autopsies. But I wouldn't want to send a patient to a hospital that forbids autopsies. What if you have that 1 in 1,000 case or whatever it is when Jewish law would require it? So we want things to be allowed, and let the patient, let their family, let with their own religious or whichever communal support, let them to determine what is most meaningful to them, the way they live their lives, and we will support them in order to live according to their lifestyle and their beliefs. And so finally, the last point, and it's really kind of a triple header, because I put it into one, it could be many, but I just think finally, there are a number of values that I think inform what it means to be Jewish hospital. And again, these values, I'm not saying these are exclusively Jewish. I'm not trying to claim that only Jewish hospitals have these values. It's just that there's kind of an added burden of emphasis on these that a Jewish hospital should focus on. Number one, care for body and soul. A Jewish hospital, as we see from the history, should be a place where it's not just a place of physical healing, right? Remember the example of Mount Sinai that I gave of building a synagogue in the hospital before they built an operating room, right? Putting up mezuzahs on the doors, recognizing that symbols have an impact on healing. The ability to engage with one's own meaning and community and lifestyle enables healing. And in fact, in the Jewish prayer of healing, Mishaberach, we call it, the prayer itself, we say in Hebrew, Refuat HaNefesh, Refuat HaGuf. We pray for a person to heal spiritually, emotionally, and physically. And we actually put the emotional healing first, based on the belief that, you know, to heal physically, a person needs to be emotionally cared for as well. So there's that aspect, care for the body and the soul, right? Emphasizing the whole person care. Number two, the importance of research and education, right? This focus on innovation, on education, are core Jewish values and have been really emphasized in Jewish hospitals. And to me, you know, when innovation happens at Cedars-Sinai in particular, when I talked about pride before, I can't help but thinking, you know, either when Cedars-Sinai is ranked, you know, sixth in the country, or when I hear about the incredible advances in cancer and ALS and all the different amazing research happening at this hospital, to think to myself, wow, here you have a place that was built, that was established because others said, you know, we don't want you here. We don't welcome you. We think you're dirty. We think you're subhuman. Go somewhere else. And so they said, okay, if you have to seclude us, we'll go somewhere else. But while we're there, we'll welcome anyone. We'll serve as an example. And we'll provide not just any care. We'll provide the best care possible. We'll innovate and we'll provide cures to all of humanity. And I think it's just a profound part of that exact mission. Again, going back to some of those statements made by the founders of the Jewish hospitals, that it was meant to serve as an example. And finally, this responsibility to care for the sick and the poor. The Jewish hospitals throughout their history, you find in the history in these books that I mentioned before, a constant emphasis on being a Jewish hospital meant everyone's welcome, and that it's regardless of ability to pay. There should be a welcoming of anyone. Anyone is welcome. Anyone should be cared for, and their costs should be covered as much as possible. And it's just this history of striving not to be a burden and saying, we'll care for the sick. We'll care for the poor. And the poor in particular, that is a central aspect of what it means to be a Jewish hospital. And so my argument, to summarize and conclude, and then to hear your responses, is that basically, you know, the history, this history that I'm sharing, this history of being excluded, of being marginalized, of being mistreated, of trying to find a place, it gives us a sense of focus. It gives us an anchor. And an inspiration and a commitment to these values of being inclusive, of being faith friendly, of saying there is a place for religion in healthcare, but not that it's forced on others, right? And this care for the body and soul, of research and education, of caring for the poor in particular. And that if we can remember this past of where we come from and why these hospitals exist, it can enable us and inspire us to build a better world.